Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In my experience, watching and to some extent waging that war in the past decade or two, I have rarely found someone that I have come to admire more for both his courage and his service to our country, first in uniform, subsequently as a civilian member of the FBI, and then most recently in his capacity in the private sector, than I do our guest for this full hour. His name is John Guandolo. His story is remarkable. In a way, I think it's kind of a microcosm of what we've gone through as a country in the course of the so-called war on terror. And I want to dwell on that initially, but we will talk about much more, including his insights into the nature of that war and what we have to do to try to prevail in it. I consider him both a model, an exemplar, a mentor in many ways, as well as a good friend. And I'm delighted to have a chance to talk with him at length. John Guandolo, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you for giving so generously of your time in what I know is a busy period for you. Glad to have you.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it as always.
Well, let me talk about you first, or with you, about your experiences, more to the point, John, because you of course, started out in the U.S. Naval Academy, graduating there, going into the Marine Corps. Tell us a little bit about your experiences in the Marines and the insights that you took away in particular from your service in Desert Storm about the nature of the enemy we're up against and the challenge we face in defeating them.
The things I learned in the Marine Corps center around leadership. As a Marine officer, you know, I went to Ranger School, which is an Army school, and it's a leadership school. Essentially leading people under very rigorous conditions. I think the Army does it right in that training. And not only in the things I did in the infantry and in combat, and I'll come back to that to answer that question, is the things I learned at the Force Reconnaissance Company and working with what I think are, some amazing Marines. And I was honored to be there and serving with those kind of people. But even in training, the high-risk things that those kind of units do, not just the nature of the insertion techniques like, free-falling or diving or however it is, boats. It's the leadership. It's the planning. It's the training. And in combat, planning and preparing and training and doing it realistically.
But also being informed by, a realistic sense of the battlefield, the nature of the enemy, their doctrine and all of that. I mean, you studied it carefully and you had to know it in order to have a chance of prevailing.
Well, and that's the thing that I think I would say about the enemy is this enemy doesn't stop unless they're defeated. They have to be utterly defeated. In Iraq and in Kuwait, the enemy was overwhelmed, and that's how you win. And when you know their doctrine, you know that their defeat mechanism is you have got to completely defeat them, or they will not stop, because the Sharia tells them if they have an opening, it's because they have to keep waging jihad. And so, yes, knowing that matters on the battlefield, and there are all kinds of things that matter on the battlefield, like knowing what does it mean, when they make a truce? What does it mean when they do certain things? And so all of that is relevant in this war. And the vast majority of, Marines and soldiers and sailors, and more importantly, the leaders are not being taught that and don't know that.
I want to come back to that, John Guandolo. After you left the Marines in the post-Desert Storm environment, you wound up going over to the FBI. Talk about both what you did in the Bureau and, again, lessons learned, insights obtained from that experience for what you're doing now.
Well, when I went into the FBI, I came out of a special operations unit, Force Recon, in the Marine Corps. And so I was immediately interested and asked to be involved in the SWAT team at the FBI. I had come out, I was essentially qualified because of what I had done inside the Marine Corps as a trauma EMT. And so I had not only just basic EMT skills, I had advanced skills. And so that opened doors for the Bureau wanting to send me to paramedic school. So I literally was sent to 4 months of paramedic training. And my first 4.5 years or so, I was on a criminal unit, first 5 years really, on a criminal unit. And so I was doing criminal work, but the medical stuff opened doors for me to do all kinds of things in the Bureau that a lot of people didn't get to do. And those experiences, a lot of them, for instance, the 1998 bombings in Africa, and primarily going over because of my paramedic skills, was eye-opening. And that's not really a good way to describe it, but, you know, scraping pieces of human beings off the side of the embassy wall for the sake of recovering their remains leaves a mark. And the brutality of this enemy, and then having to deal with them on the ground and participating in raids in Africa, places like where the bomb was actually made, and dealing with the Al-Qaeda planner and bringing him back to the United States, and having to deal with one of the people who had been in the actual vehicle. All of that, these things gave me an insight, and watching these guys and listening to them being interviewed and dealing with them firsthand. And then we fast forward to 9/11 and literally being at the Pentagon after, the day of 9/11, and for many weeks after, helping with the recovery efforts there and working the investigation. And the same thing I would say, the one thing that I would, for your listeners, is this enemy is not, they're not compassionate. They're not open to reason. They are mission oriented, and their goal is clearly to establish a caliphate under Sharia, and they're going to do it any way possible, and they're willing to go the whole distance to do it.
We're going to talk more about the enemy and what we've got to do to contend with him with John Guandolo momentarily. But John, just to finish up this really extraordinary personal biography and how you have come to have the insights that you have. You migrated into the counterterrorism side of the Bureau, as I understand it, and were involved in, among other things, bringing to justice Abdurrahman Al-Amoudi, one of the kingpins of the Muslim Brotherhood. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
So not long after 9/11, the Washington Field Office established two very aggressive counterterrorism units. And our unit, one of the things we did was go after guys at the ground level in and around the Washington, D.C., Northern Virginia, not just involved in 9/11, but also guys that were involved in other stuff. And the unit I moved over to, I ended up being the squad that did the raid in the El Barassi raid where the Muslim Brotherhood archives were located. And then eventually the unit was the one that we actually picked up Al-Amoudi at the airport when he was transitioned from the UK after having been arrested there with $340,000 cash he got from Libya for the global jihad. And then we brought him back. And actually, I was the last one to interview Al-Amoudi, who was not only a Muslim Brotherhood and a leader and the most prominent Muslim leader in America, but it turns out he was a financier for Al-Qaeda. And so I was the last one to interview him the day before he was sentenced in the Eastern District of Virginia.
To some 23 years, as I recall, in federal prison where he remains to this day. John Guandolo, as I say, that personal trajectory from the military through the FBI and fighting the enemy in various incarnations and places, I think has equipped you brilliantly to do the sort of work you're doing now. We'll draw on some more of your insights from those experiences when we come back with John Guandolo, the founder and president of Understanding the Threat and the author of Raising a Jihadi Generation, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're visiting for this full hour with a decorated and, I believe, under-recognized hero of the war for the free world. His name is John Guandolo. These days he runs his own outfit called Understanding the Threat. But we've been talking with John a little bit about some of his experiences leading up to that position, and they're extraordinary in many respects. And John, I did want you to talk a little bit about what you tried to do inside the Bureau before you left a few years back to make sure that a problem you mentioned right out of the box, namely the lack of understanding of many in the uniformed ranks as well as in the FBI and other what I think of first lines of defense here, particularly in the homeland, as well as our leaders, their lack of understanding of the nature of the enemy as you have come to know him. Talk a little bit about the training program that you did in the FBI before you retired.
Okay. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. Once, through a series of investigations that we were running and that I was directly involved in, I came to understand that there is an Islamic movement here in the United States. It is led by the Muslim Brotherhood primarily, and that all of the prominent Islamic organizations in the United States are a part of this movement whose stated objective is to wage civilization jihad to overthrow the U.S. government and implement an Islamic state under Sharia. That's a matter of fact in evidence in a number of terrorism trials, but most notably the U.S. versus the Holy Land Foundation for Relief and Development in Dallas in 2008. When this was all going on, like after 9/11, when I moved over to the counterterrorism division, I would be calling different field offices to discuss these matters with other agents. And when I brought up the Muslim Brotherhood, nobody knew who they were. Or when I would call and ask the agents at the Indianapolis office or LA or Seattle, why have you shut down cases on these specific individuals who are Muslim Brotherhood leaders? And the answers were always because the ASAC, the assistant special agent in charge for counterterrorism, was having lunch with this individual and told him to shut the case down because the guy's a good guy. I realized this was a massive lack of understanding of what was actually going on. So after having a series of conferences that I set up myself and invited people from around the country to come in and lay some of this out, it dawned on me that what I needed to do was set up a training program. And so I did that. I did what I needed to do to get it all set up. It was a long process. And in August of 2006, I ran that training program. And of course, at that point, I had reached out to you and had asked you to come in and moderate day one, the discussion that we did. And it was incredibly successful. And I'll just say this about that program. It was August 2006. We had approximately 50 people from every FBI, CIA, DHS, DIA, NSA, local and state police. We had assistant U.S. attorney in the room. We had DOJ analysts. We even had the number two guy at the CT division for DOJ stopped in and gave his thumbs up for the training. And in the after action reports, the people said unanimously, everyone needs to have this training. And of course, the response from the FBI was, hey, good job. But, you know, now you're 2 months behind in your casework and your source reporting is behind, and I got dinged for all that.
And ultimately discouraged from continuing and doing it, as I recall.
Yeah, exactly, because what ended up happening is, because agents had attended this, I would get emails almost daily from agents around the country that had been at this program And they would communicate with me and said, hey, did you see this? Because now they could see events in the United States and internationally through a very different lens, and a lens that gave them a true and real understanding of the threat. And so as I continued to challenge our leadership at the FBI, saying, look, these guys that you're working with, these are bad guys, and here's why. But they could. There are two things here. There's a complete lack of understanding of the nature of how this enemy is fighting the war, that it's not primarily shooting and killing and kidnapping and blowing things up. That's not primarily what they're doing. It's subversion. These are suit-wearing jihadis who present themselves as friendly, who are not. And the other thing is, in the Bureau, it's all about, well, show me a law they're breaking right now, and then we can lock them up. So the idea of a long-term conspiracy that take action, some legal, some not legal, in order to bring about the larger conspiracy, which is to overthrow the U.S. government, which is against the law, they could not conceptualize that.
Right. Let me ask you about something that you touched on a moment ago. You mentioned that you had been part of the team that raided Ismail El-Barassa's home in Annandale, Virginia, back in 2004. It's a remarkable story of really divine providence, as far as I'm concerned, that safe house essentially came to the attention of the law enforcement community. And you found inside that house scores of banker boxes worth of documents that turned out to be the archives of the Muslim Brotherhood. But I did want you to talk about one of those documents that was introduced in the trial you mentioned, the Holy Land Foundation trial, and the insights that it provided into the Muslim Brotherhood's civilization jihadist plan.
Yes, so I'm assuming you're talking about the explanatory memorandum. One thing I want to be very clear for your listeners is that the explanatory memorandum wasn't just some document. This was a document written by the number two guy in the Palestine Committee, which is Hamas in the United States. And for your listeners, Hamas is an inherent part of the Muslim Brotherhood. And of course, that's a designated terrorist group. And so you have a document that lays out the strategy for the Muslim Brotherhood and defines it not only as civilization jihad by our hands, getting our leaders to do their bidding for them, but it specifically says in there that we must create organizations because America is a country that only understands legitimacy when you create organizations. And so for those people that dismiss this document as not being somehow official, you are right. It was not only entered into the trial, into the Holy Land Foundation as evidence. What followed that, when that was presented to the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood, was in 1992, the Muslim Brotherhood's implementation manual, which is an excruciatingly detailed list of tasks in order to achieve the things that are listed in the strategy. So it is the actual working document, and it's on the Understanding the Threat website. I encourage people, even if you don't read it, just flip through it. It lists all the action items, who's going to do it, the time to do it, and who's going to follow up. And what we see is exactly in that time frame, 92, 93, after the strategy is laid out, after the implementation manual is approved and published by Muslim Brotherhood leadership, we then see every year from that point in the early 90s to today, between 80 and 120 Islamic nonprofits are created. And the ones that are created are exactly matching the things that they lay out in the implementation manual.
That has been implemented assiduously. And that's why this is such an important document. And the fact that we have had it in our possession since 2004 and learned so little from it is evidence of, well, I call it malfeasance. A more charitable term for it is willful blindness. And I want to talk about, when we come back from a short break, how that willful blindness not only brought to an early and, I think, most regrettable end your career in government, but also has impinged so dramatically on our ability to understand, let alone to counter, the Sharia supremacists we confront today. That and much more with John Guandolo of Understanding the Threat, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
This is the third installment of our full hour-long program with John Guandolo, a personal hero of mine in the war for the free world, who these days runs an indispensable outfit, Understanding the Threat. But we've been talking about how he got to that point and the kind of training that he was doing inside the government until basically he was forced to stop doing that training. And it speaks to something, John, that we've been wrestling with ever since. This phenomenon of willful blindness is two hearings on Capitol Hill, one by Senator Cruz, the other by Representative Scott Perry last year, exposed very clearly operating inside successive administrations. I'm sorry to say, I think including this one. But talk a little bit about what happened to you personally in the FBI that gave rise to your, I think, premature departure from the organization.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to do it. So after August of 2006, when I ran the first training program in the government that dealt with these issues, the Muslim Brotherhood, Sharia, and how they do what they do, immediately after, I got notified by some very senior case agents, a couple of whom had been at the training, and these were very good agents, actually out of the Phoenix office, who had dealt with Al-Qaeda leading up to 9/11, prior to 9/11, and they notified me that on September 11th, 2006, there was going to be a unity march in Washington, D.C. and in New York. And one of the leading organizations working with this group was Hamas, doing business as the Council on American Islamic Relations.
Now, when you say there's that connection, John, just let me ask you to digress for one second. Why do you call CARE, as it's better known, a front for Hamas?
Because the evidence in the Holy Land Foundation, as well as the Muslim Brotherhood's history, shows that the U.S. Muslim Brotherhood, on the orders from the International Muslim Brotherhood, created a Palestine committee here in the United States, which was to be Hamas here. And the leadership of the what came to be known in 1994 when it was created, CARE, was created by primarily by Omar Ahmad and Nihad Awad, who were two very prominent leaders of the Palestine Committee. Omar Ahmad was on the executive committee of the U.S.-Palestine Committee, which is Hamas, the United States. And they came from the Islamic Association of Palestine, which the government recognizes as a Hamas entity, and they created CARE. And we have numerous documents. I mean, the federal judge in the Holy Land Foundation said the government has produced, and this is a quote, produced ample evidence to establish the associations of CARE, ISNA, and NATE, which are two other groups, but CARE with the Hamas Front, IAP, with the Holy Land Foundation, and with Hamas itself.
Now, and one of those documents, John, it's important to note, was a wiretap conducted by your old outfit, the FBI, at the organizational meeting of the Council on American Islamic Relations back in 1993. So this is a locked down case. I just wanted to make sure we were properly calibrated on the nature of this organization, CARE. So there it was, leading a unity rally on September 11th, 2006. And then what happened?
Well, and the other thing I would say is that Understanding the Threat, for your listeners, right on our homepage, there's a block that says CARE of Hamas. Click it, and it's a short list of some of that evidence. But so I bring this to the attention of who CARE is to the organizer of the unity walk. What I did not know at the time was that he was actually a sympathizer of the Muslim Brotherhood. He was not a Muslim, but I believe he has since converted, but he was a sympathizer. When I laid out the information, now this is, you know, end of August 2006, after our two-week initial training program, I get this information, I'm notifying this guy. Well, he notifies CARE that he got this call from the FBI. Now, this is before, this is the Friday before Labor Day weekend. So I make this call. He notifies care. I come into work Tuesday morning. I get called to the boss's office. And what I found out happened was this guy tells care. Care comes up with a plan. They call the assistant director for counterterrorism in the FBI at our headquarters, who calls the assistant director of the FBI at the Washington field office, who calls the special agent in charge of counterterrorism. And they're all sitting with my supervisor in the office when I walk in, and they just rip me a new one because the leadership of CARE is upset that I did this. And that's where it began.
Let me just emphasize one other thing, John, if I can, because this is so important. In addition to the great work that you have published at Understanding the Threat, at securefreedom.org, you can find the actual transcript of this wiretap and some annotations reflecting testimony in the Holy Land Foundation trial by one of your colleagues, Linda Burns, and some other additional material that subsequently came to light. People need to really understand the nature of this organization when they are hearing stories like this, John, that a distinguished, highly skilled, highly qualified FBI agent doing leading edge work in the counterterrorism space was essentially taken out by CARE. So I just wanted to give that background. Everybody can take advantage of these online resources, and I hope they will. So pick up your narrative quickly, John, if you would.
Well, so that began then some friction, needless to say, and I laid out who these guys were. But, you know, the response I got was, listen, if we can arrest them for something, let's do it. And the point is, the investigation is as much a conspiracy to overthrow the government as it is an espionage matter. And so in the counterterrorism division, they don't want to hear about espionage or counterintelligence. That's a totally different world. So that's not how we dealt with things, which is another part of the problem. But following this, so right on the heels of that, at FBI headquarters, I find out they're doing a presentation by a guy named Irfan Shahid from the Alawid bin Talal Center for Christian and Muslim Understanding at Georgetown, which is a Saudi-funded terrorist propaganda center by Prince Alawid bin Talal, is one of the largest single donors of the global jihad on the planet. And I go and I listen. And it's not only propaganda. I mean, he is flat out calling out the United States for being the problem, saying that, jihad and martyrdom are legitimate because of the way the Muslim world's being treated. And in FBI headquarters auditorium, in front of hundreds of people and being live streamed across the FBI, at the end, I finally stood up and just called them out for this BS. And following this, I wrote a letter to the assistant director of the FBI for public affairs, who is John Miller, the former ABC reporter who interviewed bin Laden, and just asked him, I mean, how incompetent are you to bring in a suit-wearing jihadi to FBI headquarters?
For the purpose of indoctrinating the personnel in the FBI. I mean, again, this speaks to the point that I'm making about disarming our first lines of defense. We've got a book on this, as you know, John, called See No Sharia. And it just, this tale and what happened to you next is a prime example of the purging and the willful blindness and so on. John, we're going to have to pause for just a moment here. I do want to just wrap that part of the story up. But let me just say, what you've described here in terms of the penetration of our government and the influence operations that have been run against it, and specifically the extent to which this Muslim Brotherhood apparat doing business under various fronts, notably but not exclusively the Council on American-Islamic Relations, has actually taken down not just individuals like yourself, but our situational awareness. Call it willful blindness. Andy McCarthy calls it compulsory blindness. Whatever we think of it is, you know, the diversity, sensitivity, political correctness. The enemy, as you know better than just about anybody, John Guandolo, calls it something else. They call it submission. And that makes them far more emboldened and more dangerous, and why the work that you're about now, John, at Understanding the Threat is so centrally important. We'll talk more about that work with John Guandolo right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
John Guandolo is our guest for this extraordinarily important, very special hour-long presentation of Secure Freedom Radio. These days, he is the president and the founder of Understanding the Threat. You can find his work at understandingthethreat.com. He has been an extraordinary resource, leader, combatant in the war for the free world, both in uniform and at the FBI. And John, you just need to finish up your story about your time at the FBI, the purge, and what you have been doing since.
Well, so after I had this email exchange with Assistant Director John Miller, that exchange actually was somebody picked it up. I don't even know how that exchange got picked up, whether Miller shared it with somebody or something, but it went viral across the FBI. I mean, I was getting calls and emails from all over the FBI of me dressing down the assistant director for his ignorance of the threat. And so because of that, he launched an internal investigation on me for insubordination and disrespect. But the FBI director at the time had a policy that exchange is something Mueller actually encouraged. In other words, you can have an open exchange, and it was never, went beyond the bounds of that. And Miller wasn't even in my chain of command. So that went nowhere, but that really blew up, headquarters anger at me. And what ended up happening was headquarters, because of my training, was getting calls from the CIA, from the NSA, from the Department of Defense to request me as a speaker. And it was making them angry because I was just a case agent at the field office. I wasn't in training division at Quantico, and I wasn't in the CT training section up at headquarters. So all of that, essentially what they did over time, and I was able to run early in 2007, I was able to quietly run another program with the park police. But anyway, when that was ended, that was it. And so what ended up happening was I took so much heat that they eventually pulled me out of the CT division. They put me on a surveillance unit. And as my buddies on the surveillance unit said, now that they've given you a lot of time, free time during the day with a phone and a computer, and they knew that I was going to wreak havoc, and I did. Finally, I was given the order, you cannot speak about this topic. You cannot email about this topic. And if you do, we are going to open up another internal investigation. So, essentially, I became dead in the water. And I had met some people at the Department of Defense who said, look, we think you need to stay in the FBI, but if you ever kind of go dead in the water, let us know. And I did. And to my surprise, they offered me a job and said, can you start tomorrow? Well, what it meant was at the end of December 2000 or the beginning of December 2008, they recruited me out of the FBI to significantly more pay and a heck of a lot more freedom. And I went out and I briefed members of Congress, heads of Judiciary, Intel, Homeland Security committees, 3- and 4-star generals and admirals. And what I found was the level of understanding among those people was no better than it was of the average FBI agent in the Bureau. There was no understanding of Sharia, no understanding of the broader network and how they operated both in the United States and internationally. And so that program that I worked with in 2012 was defunded by the Obama administration, then I created Understanding the Threat to continue the work. And that's what I'm doing now.
And that work, John, again, I cannot say how highly I regard it. Talk a little bit about the training you're doing now. Who are the audiences you're speaking to? What kind of response are you getting from them with respect to their level of awareness before the training, their understanding of the problem afterwards?
Right. So the goal in understanding, when you understand the nature of this battle and how penetrated, as you said earlier, we are, not just at the federal level, the way the Muslim Brotherhood works at the state level with state legislatures, with school boards, with businesses, chambers of commerce, I mean, the whole nine yards, with interfaith outreach. When you look at how organized they are, this problem has to be solved at the local level. Local police, with the support of local citizens, going after these organizations and leaders in the Islamic movement here in the United States and really uprooting them from the community and dealing with them using, you know, very aggressive means legally here in the United States.
Now, let me just ask you, this is an important point that I just want to make sure you're speaking to directly, John Guandolo, and that is that you have concluded on the basis of your very considerable experience with these things that what we are actually confronting at this point isn't just this civilization jihad and the, you know, sort of building out of an infrastructure for perhaps the more violent kind in the future, but we're actually dealing with what you call an insurgency. And that using your knowledge and experience with counter-insurgency doctrine and practice, that it really does require those local authorities to be kind of the pointy end of the spear. Is that right?
That is exactly right. And it's, we're seeing, and what we have seen for several years, is the Islamic movement working directly with the hard left Marxist movement, cooperating with each other to bring about the same end, which is the overthrow of the U.S. government. And we detail this. And so what we believe is the most important element, the goal is to get law enforcement trained so they understand this, and I'll speak about this in a second, but they have to have the backing of the citizens. So we believe sheriffs and pastors are the two most important leader groups, if you will, that need to understand this threat. And what we're finding is the best way to get that done is to get citizens, you know, whether it's political groups, civic groups, church groups, to get this information in large numbers. And then what they're able to do is go to their sheriffs who they have a personal relationship with because they supported them in their elections and whatever, to bring the training in and then spread and then go to their pastors and encourage them to speak truth about this. And that is like wildfire that's catching, because what we do in our 3-day law enforcement program is we spend a whole day on the overview of the threat and on Sharia, which the enemy says in the Islamic movement is the basis for everything they do. An entire day on the network, the Muslim Brotherhood network, the Shia network, the Iranian network, the Tabliki network, it's all working as a part of the Islamic network here, and the hard left Marxists, how they work together.
Even though they seemingly have very different characteristics or at least longer term agendas.
That's right. And in the end, the Islamic movement will destroy those in the left, the Marxist movement. But it doesn't matter. They'll still achieve the goal, according to them, of overthrowing the U.S. government, because that's their intent. And on the third day of this 3-day law enforcement program, we literally show them how knowing this information changes the statement of facts, facts that go into probable cause, reasonable suspicion, how it changes interviews, what you see on a search warrant, traffic stops, and how you can investigatively map out the network and go after this network. And we're the only ones in the country doing it, which is why we're taking so much heat. And to answer your key question, the response to the training is all of the law enforcement that we train, including people from the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force, tell us we've never heard this information, number one, and number two, it's critical to protecting the communities in which these, you know, law enforcement people are working in.
Yeah, indeed, the country as well, needless to say. And John, this is why I regard what you do with your training program, understanding the threat, to be such an indispensable and continuing public service, and why we're proud to support you, and including having one of our own, Claire Lopez, participating in many of your programs. This is vital work. I'm so proud of you for doing it. And when we come back, I want to talk about, finally, both how the willful blindness is affecting policy in the Trump administration and what we can do about that. That and more in our final installment with John Guandolo, straight ahead.
go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. The final block in this really extraordinarily important conversation with John Guandolo. I have said before, and I will say again, I regard his resource at understanding the threat, both the training that it does and material that it produces, which can be found at understandingthethreat.com, is simply indispensable. So, John, I wanted to ask you, you've set the stage for us very nicely to bring us sort of up to the present moment, purges going back to the Bush administration, the malfeasance, I think it's fair to say, of the Obama administration in this space with its, you know, countering violent extremism shenanigans and the like. But I do want to ask you about the Trump administration. At understandingthethreat.com, you wrote a few weeks back a scathing review of H.R. McMaster, the president's national security advisor, calling him unfit for the job because of his willful blindness at best in this part of the battle space. Talk a little bit about how you've arrived at that conclusion and its implications.
Well, you just a moment ago used the word malfeasance, and I concur. And when a person is unprofessional in their duties and people die as a result, legally that's called criminal negligence, and we put doctors and lawyers in jail for that. So I want to begin the discussion right there. Now, Mr. McMaster, Herbert McMaster, is the National Security Advisor to the President of the United States, and he has openly said on numerous occasions that ISIS practices an irreligious view of religion. He's also called it a perverted version of religion, which is untrue. It's categorically untrue. What ISIS states is exactly in line with Sharia, which is Islamic doctrine. And so to say that this has nothing to do with Islam is categorically false, and it's counterfactual to the truth. And therefore, he's unprofessional. And because we have Americans who have been killed in overseas and here in the United States, I think he falls into that criminally negligent category.
And his recommendation, we're about to send perhaps as many as 4,000 more to Afghanistan, where many of them may meet a similar fate.
Yes, and let me highlight that, because I also last Thursday wrote an article about right now the Islamic movement, based on UTT's assessment, they are entering their final stage here in the United States, what they consider to be the final stage before violent overthrow and before they really ramp up the violence here in furtherance of overthrowing the United States. Now, we can have a disagreement on whether they are entering the final stage. I'm okay with that. But what I am saying is, at a time when all of this is culminating here in the United States, the Islamic movement, we are strategically taking our focus back to Afghanistan, and the people who have come up with this strategy are the very generals who lost the wars for us the first time because they refused to know the enemy. Nowhere in our national security doctrine, anywhere since 9/11, have we identified the threat. You cannot defeat an enemy you do not define, because you can't target them. So this is the enemy strategy, civilization jihad by our hands. And I just want to say, I believe that the president, in his gut, he has even said it publicly. In his gut, he knows what the threat is, that Islam is the problem. He has said, my gut tells me we should not go back into Afghanistan. But Mr. Trump comes from a generation that, in my opinion, rightfully reveres generals, military generals, Unfortunately, the generals that have been leading us, with almost no exception, have failed to understand the threat.
Well, but to be fair, John, let me just add, they have faced the prospect of what you experienced. If they do understand the threat, let alone if they acted on it, that would have been a career-ending offense. So they have been not only incentivized to go along with the program, as H.R. McMaster clearly did with Barack Obama's team. He went from colonel to a three-star general in the space of whatever it was, 6 or 7 years. But this is also, you know, got a flip side to the coin. You don't dare get into the subject at the risk of your future prospects, right?
Well, that's correct. And so in that sense, you're correct. But I would also say these generals have a duty to know this. And it's not like, you know, if you're my dad is retired and he doesn't fully understand it, although in this case he does, then no big deal. But when you're a general, a 3 or 4 star general or admiral, and you don't know this, that's a problem, because you swear an oath to protect and defend, which means you have to do due diligence to actually know the enemy.
It's a particular problem if you're the national security advisor to the president and you're surrounding him with people who are of the Obama view, some 40 of them at last count in the National Security Council, and you're purging those, like our friend Rich Higgins, who understand this problem intimately and who I think worked with the president closely to try to ensure that his interests, his instincts, his policies were advanced. John, we're almost out of time. I did want to reserve the last couple of minutes to just invite you to talk quickly about what citizens hearing your story, hearing your insights, your lessons learned, can now do to try to counter the effects of an H.R. McMaster and a general officer corps that's malfeasant, at least in many cases, and more to the point, to protect our country against this enemy within as well as without.
Well, thank you for giving me that opportunity. I would say know the threat, find out what you can do, keep focused on what's within your wheelhouse, and then take action. So first, know the threat. Understandingthethreat.com is a resource. Our resource page is loaded with information. We also have links to videos, to articles, to all kinds of things on there. And of course, one of the things we link to twice under the training and under the links is Frank, your 10-part series on the Muslim Brotherhood, which I believe is one of the best things that has been produced in the last several years on this threat. So you got to know the threat. We have a store with our books, with DVDs. We have more coming out. Bring us into your community to train. I mean, our vice president, Chris Gobbets, is the guy who went undercover at CARE in 2008. He has an intimate understanding of how these groups work at ground level. And we have changed how we do this. If you bring us into your church or your civic group for citizens, if you just pay our expenses, take up an offering for us, we will come to your community. We encourage you to bring the 3-day law enforcement program into your community so your law enforcement will know this. And so there's more information on the site. We're on Twitter at UTT_USA, at John Guandolo. We have a YouTube channel and a Facebook channel. Subscribe and like us there. We need support. So if you're able to do that, you can donate your nonprofit, you know, tax deductible donations through a 501c3 set up to support us. You can do that on the website. But most importantly is share who we are and what we're doing, because as Frank said, we're the only ones doing this in this part of the realm. I think what CSP is doing is being a leader in this movement. Frank, I thank you for that. And we need everybody involved in this war. Don't worry about how to get H.R. McMaster out. You can do what you can there, but county by county, state by state, we're going to win this war.
That's the counterinsurgency that we must fight to save our country from the red-green axis, as John has described it, the leftist-enabled Islamists of the Muslim Brotherhood and their ilk. John, the most important work of our time, you are at the leading edge of it. An inspiration, as I say, to me personally, and I think to so many others. I'm particularly grateful for the training that you're providing to our law enforcement community and to faith leaders. And I know you'll keep it up, but he'll do more and with greater effect with your help, folks. Check him out at understandingthethreat.com. John Guandola, God bless you. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.